hear me? Okay, you hear the music.
So I'm Karen Hartglass, and we are now going to start again with It's All About Food. And it wasn't that fun. I had this like moment of crazy nervousness, and now we can relax. Take a big deep breath, because that's what really matters. Everybody breathe with me. I need to let go for a minute. Okay, let's get back. Richa,
yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. You know, I've been doing this program for over 9 years, and this has never happened to me.
It's always one of the first days.
I'll tell you, I know why it happened, though. So I have a MacBook. It's a 2011. I've had all kinds of experiences with it, and recently I upgraded my operating system.
Yes.
And therein lies the disaster. All right, this will never happen again. So, Richa, am I saying it
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Richa, yeah.
Richa, does that mean something lovely?
It actually means something in Sanskrit. It's basically the verses, like if there's a poem, then those paragraphs or verses, that's they're called Richa.
Hmm, okay, it's poetic. Beautiful. All right. So you've had your own life journey, which has led you to become the knowledgeable blogger and recipe developer and chef and everything that you are. Can we hear a little bit about what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite a few years now. So I was working in software before, but I had a change in between. I had a health issue, and after that, I couldn't go back to work because of certain balance and vertigo issues. So I started doing other, well, I took a break for a couple of years, and then I was just very bored at home. So I decided to start doing something, and I started cooking whatever I wanted to. Like, I was cooking every day anyway, so I started posting it on a blog. And people started cooking whatever I was making. So I was like, okay, maybe I'm making some good stuff. So then that's how the blogging began. And in between, around that time, I also was, we adopted our dog and we were fostering a couple of dogs. So it kind of like all of those things came together. And then I went vegan and the food blog went vegan. And since then, that's what's been going on. I keep producing recipes. People like what I put out there. And publishers also liked what I was putting out there, so I wrote the first book and now the second book this year. That's how it's been.
Lovely. Did any of your audience mind when you went vegan?
I was a really small blog when I went vegan, so I don't think anybody, I mean, there were probably very few people following me at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's clearly an influence of Indian cuisine in your food, mm-hmm. and your first cookbook was all about vegan Indian food. Mm-hmm. And there are some wonderful things about Indian food. They use grains and beans, spices, all kinds of wonderful flavors. But I've always struggled with, even if it's vegetarian or vegan, it's always in the restaurants, like so many restaurants today, very oily, very salty. And and I sit in a restaurant and I enjoy the flavors, and then I come home and I just want to die. And I can't drink enough. And I've noticed in your recipes that you really don't indulge in the oils and, you know, it's salt to taste, which is really the way to go with this food.
Well, yeah, I mean, like Indian food, the whole, I mean, everyday Indian food is not really oil heavy, or even, you know, a lot of the Indian everyday dishes or vegetable dishes are not very spice heavy either. They're just celebrating the local and seasonal produce. So what you eat in the restaurant, you obviously are going to get more oily, more spicy, more salty, more creamy, and, you know, whatever they want to add to it, because they want the people to keep coming back, and they will always pick up the flavors which are generally more, I don't know, popular or acceptable and stuff like that. So there's a lot of Indian cuisine which doesn't get discovered in the restaurants. So there's all of that in the book. So there is some of the favorite restaurant style sauces, and then a lot of the everyday vegetable, bean, dals, curries that we eat, you know, in different parts of India. So there are a lot of regional cuisines covered in the book as well. And some use only like one or two spices, some use like different, you know, layers of different spices at every point. So you find a variety in the book which you can attempt based on what your experience so far cooking Indian food is.
I really enjoyed the chapters, the way you divided up your recipes in this book. So when we look at a classic cookbook, it's typically appetizers, hors d'oeuvres, main dishes, sides, desserts, and then maybe you'll get some extra chapters on soups and salads and breads. And this is nothing like that.
Are you talking about the second book or the first book? I think you're talking about the second book, right?
I'm on the second book, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so what was happening with the second book was, after I made the Indian book, now I had like a collection of lots of different cuisines. And there were a lot of meals that I had collected for the book, and we were trying to organize them so that they made it easier to cook through the book. Because I can't make like one or two chapters full of meals. Like there'll be 60 or 80 meals in just one chapter. So then I went with what people like think about when they're going to cook a meal. Sometimes it's based on what you want to eat, like the form factor, like whether you want to eat a burger or a pizza or a casserole, or whether you're craving certain flavors like peanut butter. Like you want to cook something Thai, Asian, Indian, or really spicy, so buffalo sauce based or something like that. So I took those and organized the recipes, and it kind of worked in terms of each chapter getting a good number of recipes. So we went with that.
It absolutely did work. So, you know, you just mentioned you might be craving one thing or another, or craving peanut butter. I think in my family, we're always craving peanut butter.
Yeah, that's the first chapter. There's a reason it's the first chapter.
And, you know, it's funny when you make these realizations or these discoveries, things that are just right in front of your face all the time, but you never think of using them for things like peanut butter for a sauce. Now, sure, you know, occasionally I'd go to a Thai restaurant or something, and there might be peanuts in the sauce. But when I first realized, I use tahini dressing all the time in salad. So it took me, I discovered that a few decades ago, and I'd mash it up and add water to it. But then when I realized, you know, you could do that with any nut or seed butter, was, whoa, the whole world opens up with all of these different sauces and flavors and peanut butter. One of the favorite things I like to do is when I get to the bottom of the peanut butter jar and there's just a little bit left, that's the time to make a sauce or a dressing with what's left in the bottom of the jar.
Yeah, it's easier.
I don't like wasting anything, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are some wonderful peanut butter recipes and peanut butter sauces, which you also add coconut milk to.
Yeah.
Very often. Yes. Okay. So some of the other sections like masala and saag.
Yeah, now, that's the third chapter that has a few of the favorite Indian sauces and some Ethiopian recipes to get you, like, if you really like spices, that's the chapter you want to start with, like more flavor and different spices and herbs.
Or a good way for people who really don't like eating leafy greens to discover an entryway into getting your greens, because that's what saag is, right? Leafy greens?
Yeah. So there is the saag that you can make with spinach, kale, or any greens that you want. I think my recipes testers just basically use up any greens that are left over in the fridge and use it to make the sauce and then add it to either tofu or chickpeas or quinoa.
I notice you have a preference, it seems, in these recipes with in the vast world of legumes. You've got a lot of lentils and a lot of chickpeas going on, which, I mean, they're my favorites. Is there a reason why you focus a lot of recipes on those?
I think we grew up eating a lot of different lentils and chickpeas and beans. I mean, there is a vast variety of lentils and chickpeas and beans in India. It's not just one type, and they're also sometimes seasonal and local, which you don't really get here, but you do get a good variety here. So I tend to use those more often as a protein in my recipes rather than tofu. I think when I actually went vegan, I used to dislike tofu, so I didn't use it in most of my recipes then, and then I slowly started to cook it my way, and I started to like tofu, and now I do use it in my recipes. But there's like a distribution of what you can use the sauces with, and you can use them with various different types of protein, and which is what the book has a distribution of those recipes. So you can use that some sauce with lentils. Like it's an example recipe that you can use it with lentils, and then there's another example recipe to use a different sauce with chickpeas, but you can also use tofu or lentils or chickpea flour tofu or meat substitute if you want. So those are just like example recipes with lots of variations. Some of the variations are mentioned with the recipe, so it's basically you can keep making variations and have like months and months worth of meals from this book.
I think I read somewhere that there are some 45,000 varieties of legumes.
That's a lot. I don't know if there are those many. If there are, then it'll be awesome, right?
I know. So tell me, how many lentil varieties do you know? I mean, I know brown and green and red.
Let's see. I have the yellow lentils, which is mung dal. Then there are a bunch of different types of split peas, which is tur dal, chana dal. Then what other lentils do I have? There's the black lentils. The brown lentils, there are different varieties within the brown lentils. So there'll be Spanish, Indian, and within those you might have like slightly different colors and variations as well. What other... That's pretty much it.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but resist talking about gas when talking about beans. Okay? Because I like to talk about all aspects of food, and a lot of people, especially when they haven't been eating plant-based diet and they try beans, they have a lot of flatulence, they have a lot of bloating, and they're uncomfortable. And and there are you probably have got some tips that you can recommend, but I've noticed, well, I read that lentils are one of the beans that will offer less of this.
Yeah, lentils are much easier to digest. And except
that I don't have that experience. Okay. So I don't have a big problem with beans, but brown lentils, I don't know.
Do you have the same problem with red lentils?
No, red are very friendly and lovely. They cook so fast. They melt in your mouth. I love them. It's just those bigger brown lentils. We don't have a good relationship.
Maybe you're just, it's just those lentils, I guess, don't eat them.
I do eat them because I love them. But then I always notice, oh, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
So are there some tips you can do?
So with beans or even like whole lentils, I usually like to soak them and then I throw the water away with the beans, which are generally known to create flatulence. I will also give them a quick boil and then throw that water and then cook them and use them. I tend to use them within 1 or 2 days of cooking the beans. That also helps. And if you're really prone to flatulence, then stay away from the canned versions.
Yeah, the can tends to be a little easier.
No, but they create more flatulence for some reason.
Oh, they do. Okay. Yeah. I haven't bought canned lentils in a long, long time.
Like for beans, especially, because a lot of people want to use black beans, chickpeas, all canned, but they kind of tend to create more of the issues.
Yes, it's an important topic to talk about when we're talking about beans. But people should know that if they do have a problem, that I believe they can get relief. And sometimes just by eating a small amount of a bean every day, just like a tablespoon or something, can help.
Yeah, slowly ultimately get into it.
Yeah, as you create your gut flora. Mm-hmm. Right. So another thing is you have a chapter on breakfast for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very big into savory for breakfast. It's not quite an American thing. A lot of us in the United States have been brought up on those sugary, sweet breakfast cereals, but savory for breakfast is...
Yeah, that entire chapter is savory breakfast. I think we always eat savory breakfast because I guess Indian food doesn't have any... I don't remember eating any sweet breakfast ever. So we're very... Like, I personally prefer savory to sweet, so that kind of shows in my recipes as well. And then when I was writing up the chapters, this is what, because these breakfasts are pretty hearty, so you can basically make them into brunch or lunch. So that's why that chapter came about. And it has some really good frittata recipes.
Frittatas are fabulous. And I love to say that making a vegan frittata is so much better in so many ways than using eggs, because chickpea flour, you can have that on hand at any time. And eggs, aside from the whole cruelty disaster with the way we raise chickens today, eggs don't last forever. And you can always have chickpea flour, which is the most magical flour on the planet, ready for you at any time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pictures are gorgeous, especially of the frittatas. Yes. One last thing I wanted to talk about, and that's you have all these wonderful, flavorful sauce recipes. And for people that are going vegan, there are all these hair-splitting details out there in the world in restaurants where we don't know what's in the sauces a lot of the time. And it's a leap of faith when we're eating in a restaurant to really trust what we're getting. And in Thai restaurants, for example, or in places that have these green and red curries, as you mentioned in their book, there's often fish paste or shrimp paste. And is that really necessary?
I know, it's not really necessary, but that's how I guess traditionally things are done. So then people continue to do that. But I do have a green curry paste and red curry paste recipe to make from scratch in the book. And they are really, really flavorful and not that difficult to make. So there are like options that you can make, either make those sauces, or if you can find vegan versions of them, then, you know, it makes things easier that you can use those and then take up a recipe from that chapter and use that sauce or paste, and you're like, you have a great meal.
You're right. Well, Richa, thank you so much for joining me. I apologize for the technical stuff in the beginning of the program, but I want to say this is a really fun book. This Vegan Reaches, not your Indian kitchen book, but your new everyday kitchen book.
Yeah.
I didn't even get to see your Indian kitchen book, and now I'm really curious to see it. But there are a lot of fun recipes, great sauces, fun things to make for parties, things like that. So I hope everybody has a chance to dig into this one. It's very tasty.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen, for having me.
Okay, thank you. Be well.
Yep.
That was Richa Hingle. And she has this new cookbook, Vegan Reaches Everyday Kitchen. Okay, now let's move on to another gorgeous cookbook. And we're going to be speaking in a moment with Chef Tommy McDonald, who's the head chef at Field Roast in Seattle, Washington. And this is the first official cookbook for Field Roast. Field Roast, 101 Artisan Vegan Meat Recipes to Cook, Share, and Savor. Welcome to It's All About Food, Tommy.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm really good. You know, when I I first got your cookbook, I have to confess, because I didn't read it right away, I thought it was a cookbook on how to use all the field roast products.
And well, I thought, yeah, it's got some of that in there too.
I know you do, for those who don't want to always go into all the steps, but you gave away all your secrets.
We sure did. That was kind of the point of the book, I think.
Thank you for that. You know, we've done some of those things in the past. It's a really, what do I want to say? Artisan. It's art, the way you make a lot of these foods. So let's just dig into it. First, let's talk a little bit about David Lee and the Field Roast Company.
Sure, let's do it.
Right. So I understand Field Roast is 20 years old.
Correct. I started in 1997 here in Seattle.
Right. And the company has a lot of lovely people-oriented feeling about how they treat the people in the company and the products that are made. There's like a vegan philosophy almost.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, we're an all vegan company. Beyond that, we're a company that was founded by a chef. So part of David's food philosophy is that you can't make good food without love. So part of us creating a good, quality food is that there has to be love going into the food. There has to be touch points with the food. We really embrace the energy that our employees and coworkers put into the food. And I think that shows in the final product, and it has, and that's our MO, and that's kind of been our calling card.
I just want to bring up a couple of points before we dig in the really delicious stuff that's in this book.
Sure.
So, number one, I know that some people are concerned because Field Roast was recently purchased by Maple Leaf, which is a meat company. And and that's happening a lot with many of the successful vegan food companies. And I imagine there are pros and cons. But can you talk a little bit about that purchase?
Yeah, for sure. It was, for us, it was something that kind of came out of the blue. We had been exploring some different ways to expand what we do, and we got an offer from a company called Maple Leaf Foods in Canada, and it was big enough to take a look at, and David felt that he owed it to the shareholders to take a look at the offer and what they're able to do and what some of these partnerships create as far as opportunities for the vegan companies that are joining into them is mostly opportunity to operate in the space with fewer obstacles. Field Roast and many other vegan companies have been fighting an uphill battle for a very long time. And for us to participate in the scope that we want to participate in the market, for us to get more vegan food on the shelves in more stores, it takes an investment of capital. And and you know, Maple Leaf and a lot of other meat companies are realizing that growth and future growth, especially in protein, is with plant-based items. So they're doing their best to find players in the plant-based world that do it right, and it's a challenge for vegan companies to find good partners. And there are, like you said, there's some pros and there's some cons, and for us, we felt like it was a very positive decision to make, and the end game for us is to get more vegan food on the shelf, and for every pound of field roast that's sold is 1 pound less of animal meat that needed
to be. That's right. Yes, I'm looking at it from a positive point of view, and I just hope everybody learns from everybody, and maybe one day Maple Leaf will be an all vegan company making all kinds of field roast and other plant meats.
Yeah, I mean, here's hoping, right?
Yes, exactly. Am I like too optimistic? I don't know. But this is the way our world works. And we have to work together. And that's how we all grow. Okay, the other thing I wanted to talk about briefly before we get into these amazing recipes is that clearly gluten, wheat gluten, is a major ingredient in all of the recipes. And gluten, unfortunately, is not for everyone.
You're right. I was just listening to a program on NPR this weekend about celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
And but you're right, and that's one thing that we've always told our customers or people who are interested in our brand. Of course, we get a lot of requests about making to make a gluten-free product. And for us, that's not really what we do, and we recognize that gluten's not for everybody. But we do feel that vital wheat gluten and wheat itself has been a staple of the human diet for a very, very long time. And that vital wheat gluten as a protein source is probably one of the most clean protein sources that we can use in a product like ours. You know, when you're isolating the protein in soy, or when you're isolating mycoprotein or other proteins that are commonly used in products like ours, it takes chemicals, it takes high pressures, temperature, and manipulating the food itself and with vital wheat gluten to separate the protein from the rest of the wheat flour itself. All it takes is water and agitation. It's something that's been done for a very long time. It was invented by Buddhist monks, and if you imagine just a ball of dough, wheat flour, and water, you put it in a tub and you work that dough, and the water starts to become milky, and that's the starches or the carbohydrates leaving the dough itself. And if you continue to do that, what you'll end up with is a ball of dough that's anywhere between 70 to 85% pure protein. And then, season it and take it from there. Right.
I've done that. I've been a vegan for almost 30 years. So, like 30 years ago when there were no products out there, I was the one with my bucket of flour in the water trying to make a tiny little ball of gluten.
Yeah. But fortunately for us, we have help. There are companies that make vital wheat gluten on a larger scale. And I've gone and toured the processing plant for the company that we work with, and it truly is the exact same process on a larger scale. So it's big old machines just shaking gluten and water. It's kind of hard to walk down the little pathway because everything's shaking and moving around you, but it really is the same. It's the same process.
Well, here's another optimistic wish for the future. I think that celiac disease and problems with wheat and gluten intolerance are not because of the wheat, actually. I think it's more because we live in a society where people are eating more industrialized foods, and there's pesticides and herbicides. There's all this discussion of glyphosate. That's an herbicide used to grow a lot of different foods, and it's used to dry the wheat when it's harvested, and it's poison. And a lot of different things like this have changed our gut flora and make it more difficult for people to digest certain foods. And I look forward to the day when we get back to where we need to be and everyone can enjoy foods that monks have been preparing for hundreds, maybe thousands of years.
Correct. Until then, We do our due diligence, and we work with a company that produces a non-GMO wheat And there's no glyphosate in the process at any point, and that's part of our strict requirements for using the product.
Oh, that's good to know. All right, let's talk about making roasts. And it's so romantic just reading the book and looking at the photographs and seeing how you wrap them in cheesecloth and tie them in string and prepare them in a Dutch oven. Where does that all come from?
Honestly, it comes from the practice of making charcuterie, which is also an old tradition as far as culinary traditions go. And our brand and Field Roast itself and the book are all truly a fusion of the two things, both making charcuterie and making our grain meat, our wheat meat. It's a fusion of Asian and European heritage as far as the culinary practices go. So we're starting with our meat, which is the wheat meat, and we're taking charcuterie and the practice of making it quite literally from that point on. And so you'll see a lot of parallels from making charcuterie using animal proteins and making charcuterie using grain and grain proteins and vegetables. So we try to apply those practices to what we do, and obviously not everything's going to work. And we've had our fair share of things that just we had to say, well, we better go back to the drawing board on this one. But we've also got a lot of winners, you know. Those roasts, you know, when you put them through the process and you, especially when you customize them, that's a nice part of this book, is that you can customize them how you want to have them. You know, we get all these comments about our product that are, you're too high in salt. I don't like the spicy one. I wish this had these other ingredients here. I'm allergic to garlic, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. We make what we make, and we have a lot of fans, but we have a lot of local people who would like something else. And part of the this book was allowing people to customize. Now, if you take that roast and you customize it and you make it by hand, that whole process is really kind of eye-opening. And like you said, it's lovely and it's wonderful. And it really, it allows you to put that good energy and love into your food. And beyond that, it just tastes great. And then you're able to customize it how you want it. I mean, the point of the book was to give people a point of origin for our food. You know, when you walk down the grocery aisles, let's say you're in the produce section and you're looking at the oranges, well, those are from California or they're from Florida. And my avocados are coming from Mexico, and my, you know, my kale is local and that comes from down the street at the farm stand or whatever, right? You walk down the meat analog aisle, if you will, and, you know, picture in your mind's eye where that is coming from. And it's really hard to do, you know, where's my fake chicken fillet come from? I don't know. So part of what this book was giving a point of origin to that, to our food and to our category of grain meat. So we thought in sharing our secrets, we could give people a point of origin, and then we would also allow them to customize it. And all in all, that should help people to kind of fall in love with what we do like we have, and inspire people to really bring what we do into their kitchen and kind of make it part of what they do too. Whether that's making it by hand from scratch or going down to the local store and having it as part of your Thanksgiving or your holiday meal.
All right, let's talk about holiday meals. You have the very beautiful holiday Wellington that uses a puff pastry. So gorgeous.
Yep, that is that's kind of two part. That comes from two places. First, we've been doing that at Field Roast for a long time. We've wrapped a roast in puff pastry for years now that we've sold, kind of a favorite for people. We sell it to a lot of grocery stores and delis, they use them in their holiday meals. So we wanted to do something like that. And then also when I was growing up, my mom, she would always make a Wellington for my sister's birthday, which was the day before Christmas. So, you know, she's basically cut out all meat and all animal products from her diet. So part of this was kind of an homage to her and kind of giving her an option for holidays. Well,
that's sweet. I love that. We all love our mom's recipes. Okay, so I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up near New York City, and there's a couple of recipes here that are really critical. One is the pastrami roast.
Yeah.
And the other is the tomato lox.
Yeah.
And you need to get these into the New York delis.
Well, I got one more for you, too. There's another one in there. It's really simple. I almost felt like I didn't need to include it, but it's kind of special around here. We do a sausage and peppers with our Italian sausage in there, and it's kind of it's a shout out to the San Gennaro Festival.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And we had a gentleman call in. He was an actor in a lot of mob movies and TV shows, if you will. And he said, you know, oh, Danny DeVito, he took me to this restaurant in LA, and he says, you got to try this, and you got to cut the meat out and check this out. And he gave me one of your sausages, and it was incredible. And so I called you right away. I got to get a pallet of your stuff. San Gennaro Festival is coming up. So he bought a pallet of it. He brought it in, and he sold like 10,000 of those sausages in like 2 days. I know.
Fantastic.
So we better put that one in the book. That was kind of a fun story.
Well, my partner Gary is Italian, and for the last few years, he has always included field roast sausages as part of the Christmas dinner.
Nice.
Yep, because you got to have sausages if you're Italian.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas, yeah.
It's going to have a lot of fennel seed in it, too.
Yeah, delicious. Well, fennel, that's an interesting flavor, too, that a lot of the Asian mock meats have used to flavor their meats. There's always a little hint of fennel in there.
Yeah. I'm from the Pacific Northwest, where there's never a shortage of fennel.
Mm.
We use it in a lot of stuff.
All right. So I just want to bring up a few other recipes that are not plant meats. One is your French toast batter with bourbon or whiskey in it.
Yep.
Is that traditional?
It is in my house. No, it's just delicious. We don't use a ton. It's just a little bit that goes into the batter, but it kind of gives like a good, I think, depth to the batter, or it kind of gives you another kind of sweet, caramely note. And it's fun, you know. And everybody's sowing the brunch now, right? Everybody gets up on Sunday, we get the friends together, we go to brunch. And I kind of want to start a campaign. Why don't you just have everybody over? You know what I mean? So I wanted
Absolutely.
To get a couple of brunch recipes where people could show off and kind of have their friends over and entertain.
I love putting beer and wine and other alcoholic beverages in cooked food. It just adds a whole delicious dimension. So I will definitely throw a little bourbon in my French toast batter. That just sounds too good.
Yeah.
Okay, last thing. I have never been a big fan of the vegan cheeses that have been available in the stores for the last decade or so. Some of the soy and rice-based sliced cheeses have just been disgusting and horrible, and like, why bother? But then chow came about, field roast chow slices, and they are really phenomenal.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think they're great. It's It's a very easy cheese to work with. It's great from a culinary perspective. You can use it for all kinds of things. I just
like chow crisps.
Like chow crisps. Isn't that like, cool?
That's a crazy thing. I can't wait to do that.
Yeah, we got a we had a person kind of send in the idea, and I thought, man, we should really work with that and kind of try it out a bunch of different ways. And you know, if you get it shredded nice and fine and lay it out on a little silk pad or like a parchment paper or something and bake it, it turns into a crispy cracker just like if you would with Parmesan or something like that.
Now the chow cheese that you have is in slices.
Yep.
And since you're doing this chow crisp thing, is there any thought about making blocks of the chow instead of in slices?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, we've got ideas for days here at Fieldroast. But I mean, as you know, and I'm sure as a lot of people know, our channel or our category is really booming. A lot of people are reducing the amount of animal products that they consume, and they're turning to alternatives, and so we are just, we're busy, you know.
We're busy.
That's the long and the short of it. So yeah, of course we are working on it. I'm not sure when we'll have it out and ready to go. Until then, that chow cheese, you can, you know what I do is if you've got a food processor, a lot of food processors will come with those disc attachments that have a shredder or a slicer, and you can just put that whole block of slices into your feed tube, push that through with the shredding blade on. I spray it with a little bit of oil, or I take a paper towel and rub it with a little bit of oil, make sure that cheese is cold, and it shreds up like a charm. It's pretty easy to work with at that point. I work with a pizza restaurant who does that, and they don't even toss any flour or anything to keep it from clumping up. It just it shreds great, and it doesn't, yeah, like I said, it doesn't clump, and I just put a little oil on there, and that really helps. So until we get it all figured out for you, that's my hack. So
all right. Looks like we've come to the end of the program. Tommy, thank you so much for joining me. I love your book, Field Roast 101 Artisan Vegan Meat Recipes to Cook, Share, and Savor. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thanks so much for joining me today. And remember, have a delicious week.